The 90s nostalgia is real. Welcome to the conversation, everybody. I'm Jessica Burbank, here to unpack the new resurgence of 90s culture and reflect on the decade that many people forgot about is Lizzie Ratner, who's the senior editor at The Nation magazine. And they've just dedicated their recent issue to reflecting upon the 90s. So thank you so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about what inspired this issue.
Well, I think, you know, the 90s often get overlooked, as you mentioned. They're sandwiched between the 1980s, the rise of the Reagan era, neoliberalism, end of the Cold War, big hair, shoulder pads, you name it. And then 2000 comes and you have this contested election, Bush v. Gore, then you have 9/11, then you have the wars on Iraq and Afghanistan in reverse order, Hurricane Katrina, 2008 Great Recession. And so the 90s are just kind of sandwiched in the middle of this. People forget about it. But if you actually stop to think about the 90s, which seemed like this tame decade, Clinton was president, there was a balanced budget, even a surplus, there was no Cold War. You actually stop to think about it and you realize that much of what happened during that decade was foundational, and that much of what's happening now can be explained if you just kind of tilt your gaze back and spend some time wandering the corridors of 90s nostalgia. And I can talk lots of ways how.
Yeah, super interested, especially, you know, during the Clinton era, people always say he did such a good job economically, but actually the conditions of forcing the private sector to go into a recession or to go into a deficit is what led to the recession a few years later. Can you just say more about the politics of the 90s shaping the years afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many forces at work, but just looking at sort of the two main ones in this country, the two main obvious ones, the Democrats and the Republicans, or the right and the center left. You can really see that both in terms of where we are today with the right, and then in terms of the burgeoning left, both the seeds really are laid in the 90s. So what do I mean by that? Let's talk about Trumpism and the right wing that we have today. Look back to the 90s and you have the rise of Pat Buchanan, who ran for president three times in the 90s. You have the Gingrich Revolution, you have the rise of Fox News, you have all these figures and forces that are still at work today, kind of really beginning to flourish in the 90s. And what they do is they build off and also rework the Reagan era politics into a politics of grievance, into a politics of nativism. Buchanan realized that with Reagan in power in the 80s, there was this new vacuum on the far right that could be exploited and needed to be exploited and resurrected and returned to. And that's what he sort of tried to do in the 90s. And so we start seeing this politics of grievance, as I said, that we have today. And we start seeing the return of nativism. You have Buchanan talking about building a wall or building a fence at the border. And so this sort of familiar culture warrior, angry white politics, frankly, really is promoted initially by Pat Buchanan, Newt Gingrich, and the so-called paleoconservatives of that era, picked up by Fox News, picked up by the Hannitys and Rush Limbaughs, and kind of percolates and marinates and then flourishes with Trump. So I think it's important to recognize Trump is not sui generis. There's nothing totally novel about him. His antecedents really were in the 90s. So that's kind of one side of the picture. Now let's talk about Clinton and the Democrats. They'd been wandering in the wilderness during the Reagan era and desperate to get back in power. And you have Clinton win on this kind of centrist, somewhat neoliberal platform. He gets into power and he is quickly challenged by this new and resurgent right. And he, in turn, starts migrating further and further to the right. Now, keep in mind, he was never a leftist candidate to begin with. He was perfectly happy to use racism to get his way into power and sort of throw people like Sister Souljah under the bus, or Ricky Ray Rector, who was on death row and a black man who he went back to Arkansas to murder so that he could kind of build up his campaign. So he was never a liberal. But as you start seeing the Newt Gingrich revolution and sort of he's being challenged in Congress, you have this resurgent right, he migrates rightward, embraces this kind of technocratic form of neoliberalism. So pausing for a second, I know I'm talking a ton, but it's hard to cram it all into such a short amount of time. You really have neoliberalism embraced at a government level in the 80s with Reagan. And that really wasn't the Democratic Party platform then. Clinton gets in and he calls himself a new Democrat, and he sort of tries to shape a new identity for the party. And it's one that embraces free market capitalism and this Reagan style neoliberalism, but with a sort of human face. So anyway, you have these sort of Clinton migrating rightward and also embracing this sort of neoliberal already rightward politics. And what that does is two things. One is it leaves the right nowhere really to go except further and further to the right, because the Democrats now kind of own the center and the sort of right. At the same time, the Democratic Party is kind of dismissing and quashing the left. And with the end of the Cold War, there was this idea, well, you know what, anti-capitalism, socialism, the welfare state, the New Deal, that's all dead. That is now in the dustbin of history. So anyone who talks about that stuff is just kind of cockamamie and crazy. So there was very little dedication on the part of the Democratic Party to those ideas and to nurturing those ideas. So that's kind of a really garbled kind of mile a minute description of some of what was at work at that time in the political sphere.
I love this. It sounds like today the 2020s are more like the 90s, beyond the blue eyeshadow coming back, right? So what can the left learn, or people who are activists or consider themselves progressives, from how similar folks were treated in the 90s?
I think there's several things. The first is that the left is in much better shape actually now than we were in the 90s. Naomi Klein has a beautiful brief essay in this 90s issue of ours that talks about the left wandering in the wilderness in the 90s. And she thinks that compared to then, the left is in much, much better shape. It's more robust. It's got a much sharper anti-capitalist analysis. It's got a feminist analysis. It's a decolonial analysis. It's much less significantly white. It's actually lots, you know, powered and peopled by people of color in a way that the left, the self-declared left in the 90s was not. So we're in a better place. That being said, I think one thing that the left can always know and remember is that you just have to keep on doing the work. And even if it seems like we're wandering in the wilderness, you're planting seeds for the future. So one or two examples, and then there's actually a great quote I'd love to read from Naomi Klein's piece. But you know, in the 1990s, in 1992, you had the LA rebellions where, you know, black residents and residents of all colors, but you know, sort of black people in LA rose up and said, the police are not gonna just be allowed to beat people and get away with it. And it was huge, and it was of unspeakable significance. And there were many more sort of anti-police brutality protests in the 90s in New York, where I'm from. There was a month of protests against the murder of Amadou Diallo. And so like people were acting then, and I think sort of that ultimately carried over into what became Black Lives Matter, you know, 20 years later. It took 20 years, but people were acting and people were thinking and people were doing, specifically and most important of all in Black communities. You know, the WTO protests in 1999 really did pave the way for some of what would become Occupy Wall Street, which would be paved the way for Democratic Socialists of America and some of the other stuff we're seeing today. Reproductive rights movement born in the early 90s. So I think it's really important to remember that a lot of the fruit of what we're doing now, we might not see it. We might not see it for a long time, but it will bear fruit. So with that in mind, and because I'm old enough to remember the 90s well, I have to adjust my glasses because I'm old, so pardon me. So Naomi Klein writes in this beautiful essay, I often pictured us, the relatively small and marginal group that still identified as leftists in those days, as jamming our foot in the heavy door of history so that the full weight of neoliberal power would not succeed in slamming it shut completely. We bruised some toes in our efforts, but we did hold it open a crack. just enough for a new generation to come along and kick it wide open. And I feel like those words are resonant. They resonate with me as somebody who was alive back then and thinking, you know, where is the drama? Where is the resistance? There was some, it just wasn't hugely visible, but it percolated, it bubbled, it stewed enough that other people could ultimately, you know, sort of pick up the torch or whatever cliche you want to use, you know, blow on the embers and allow them to burn a lot stronger.
And you've also, you and the other editors have said that there's kind of a mirroring of the political correctness we see today to that of the 90s. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I would say it's so much a mirroring of the political correctness as the culture war issues that bloomed back then are astonishingly similar. The language is slightly different. So back in the day, the right wing, which, you know, really they were the ones who fomented the culture war, and they actively, you know, Pat Buchanan and the like actively decided the culture war is the way to kind of win us votes and power. They were the ones who spoke out against multiculturalism as this awful boogeyman and political correctness, evil. And you really see that mirrored today in allegations and accusations against woke culture and allegations and accusations against critical race theory and things like that. And so really what's surprising is this thing that seemed like this, you know, hoary bygone thing you'd rather not remember is now, you know, we're reliving it. And that's a bit of a bummer, frankly, to have to go back and relive it.
You all have done such a good job reflecting upon the 90s, drawing lessons out and really summarizing what happened in a decade of politics and culture. Can you just say where people can follow your work and maybe get a copy of this if they would like to read through?
Ooh, absolutely. So our website is www.thenation.com, and you can find our special issue there on the 90s if you go to the little icon that says current issue or issues. We're at Twitter, we're at The Nation. And please come and read the issue, because there's a number of fantastic pieces on everything from food to gender and sexuality to literature to house music to, and now I'm gonna go blank all of a sudden, but to, oh my gosh, AOL and Facebook, and sort of AOL is a precursor to Facebook. So tons of excellent stuff there, and please come and read it all.
Amazing, the 90s are back. I think a lot of people will go through and read that. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks.
The University of Idaho killings captured the attention of many, going viral on social media, talking about what went down. You had Brian Koberger, who is getting a PhD in criminology, be arrested for the murder of four college students. This had people wondering, was he studying to become a better criminal? What is the overlap between people pursuing a career in criminal justice and those who are actually psychopaths? Welcome to the conversation. I'm Jessica Burbank. Here to unpack this today is Joseph Tully, who's a criminal defense attorney. He was a public defender in Fresno for many years, a top 10 criminal defense attorney by Attorney in Practice magazine, in the nation's top 1% of the National Association of Distinguished Counsel. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. So let's
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Let's unpack a little bit. You know, I think about cops a lot when I think about, you know, who is this psychopath in the criminal justice system, these people who want to exert their power and authority over others. Can you say a little bit about how you got into this topic?
Sure. I probably starting becoming a criminal defense attorney, being a public defender, I had no notion that I would become a criminal defense attorney. I didn't study for it. I didn't respect it. I had sort of the same stereotypical views as anybody did. But in being a public defender and in seeing these cases and in seeing how officers who, you know, were taught are, you know, these noble people and never lie, prosecutors and judges behaved in court, it was very eye-opening and very disappointing. And then I wrote a book in 2018, sort of based on my experiences, wanting to basically air the dirty laundry of our criminal justice system, what it's really like. And this is really before, you know, the cell phone videos came out, before George Floyd. It's really predated everything. But I really delved into a lot of the psychopathic, the overlap between psychopaths who are criminals and psychopaths who are in our court system.
It's really fascinating, you know, people talking about those who are criminals. There's this general consensus that people who commit crimes are terrible human beings. They're irreversibly bad. But some research about, you know, psychopaths, people, most of them have experienced trauma in their childhood years. Can you speak a little bit to the predestination to become someone who commits crimes? Because it's sort of been debated, right? Was Koberger someone who was trying to understand himself better and studying criminology? What's the overlap there, and is there reverse causality?
So I do think that there is a link between the fact that his undergraduate degree was in psychology, meaning he wanted to understand how human behavior, or how humans think and human behavior, and then going into criminology, there really is sort of this trackable history of, you know, perhaps that he's questioning, why am I like this? Why am I having these thoughts? And then he goes into criminology to further understand his impulses, or his, you know, his behavior, his thoughts. There's a lot of overlap between psychopaths and the criminal justice system. Again, Koberger was one, you know, coin flip away, basically. I don't know how he decided to get his PhD or to become a PhD candidate, but he could have easily gone to law school, right? And he ended up as a PhD candidate, but he was literally, you know, one decision away from being a prosecutor that we would see in a courtroom.
Yeah, can you speak to, you know, you were someone who represented, you know, criminals. Have you ever found yourself in a position where you think opposing counsel could be someone who is a psychopath, or you've worked with plenty of police officers? There's this overlap of people who are seeking positions of authority with people who tend to be psychopaths. Can you speak to that?
Sure. So there was actually a study done in 2013, and I write about it in my book, where these researchers interviewed people who turned out to be career criminals. And they asked, you know, what they wanted to be when they, you know, were younger. And a good percentage of them wanted to be a police officer. And what attracted them was the badge, the gun, the fast car, the ability to go catch the bad guys, ironically enough, and the adoration that would come with them catching the bad guy. But really, at its core, it's fundamental that that there's a seeking to impose your power over someone. And so again, the disclaimer is that there are wonderful police officers out there. There are wonderful prosecutors out there. There are wonderful judges out there. And everybody's heard of that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, or power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But what is a more important phrase is that psychopaths are attracted to positions of power. The positions of power are very attractive to people who want to exercise their authority over others, who want to, you know, impose their will on others.
That's a fascinating flip of the phrase that I really appreciate, because this idea that absolute power corrupts absolutely might prevent benevolent actors who generally want to do good in the world from ever seeking power and doing good with it. So that distinction I really appreciate. Can you say more about why you decided to take the route of a public defender after initially going in as a prosecutor?
So I didn't start out as a prosecutor, but I wanted to go into internet law. It was 1998 when I was in law school, when I graduated. It would have been perfect timing. I could have, you know, gone into a very lucrative position. I was going to law school in San Francisco, right near Silicon Valley. But I moved to Fresno, and there was no internet jobs there. And I first was very dejected that the only job I could get was as a public defender. But as so often happens in life, you know, miracles happen when you're least expecting it. And I do consider the fact that I have a trade of being a criminal defense attorney as something that's very important to my life, that I get to practice non-judgment. I get to pursue justice. It's definitely not about money. It's not a lucrative career, but you feel good and you fulfill yourself. And you were speaking earlier of, you know, people, society in general have these thoughts about criminals. I guarantee you, if anyone were to go into a courtroom, go into a criminal courtroom where they handle motions, watch what police officers do on the stand, watch what prosecutors do, watch what judges do, see what happens every day. The executive branch, you know, the prosecuting side of the fence has so much power and so much leeway that the system has become unbalanced, and our government needs checks and balances. That's what that runs our government. That's what causes it to properly function. And because the scales are now tipped in favor of the prosecution, we're suffering a lot of ills.
Yeah, it's very fascinating because of this idea that the people who are criminals are inherently bad, but interestingly, people who are psychopaths are seeking positions of power. They could be the police who are responsible for administering the law. They could be the prosecutor who's responsible for trying the case. We see a lot of disparity across class if you can't afford cash bail. For example, you can't afford private counsel, and therefore you're given a public defender who has an intense caseload that can't give you the representation that maybe the prosecution can. All of these problems suggest that law and justice are not necessarily the same in the United States. And a lot of this boils down to the disparities of class, but there's also this element of people who are maybe psychopaths are on opposing counsel or are tasked with administering the law. Can you speak a little bit about that, your experience with that in the criminal justice system?
Sure, yeah. I think there's a very famous book out a number of years ago, The Psychopath Next Door. And really what I've seen in my career is the psychopath within the court system. And I think people would be very disappointed to see how an average police officer behaves in court, how the average case that we see in court, 80 to 90% of the cases could disappear tomorrow and it wouldn't affect anybody's safety. We definitely need prosecutors, good prosecutors out there for, you know, rape, robbery, murder, burglary, you know, all the above things. But so many of the cases that are filling up our court system are just so minor and so petty that it's just really somebody being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And if it literally were to go away, the world wouldn't be a worse place. I've seen so much lying in court by police officers. Fudging the truth is the norm. Again, there are good police officers out there, but from what I've seen from my vantage point in my career is that the good people, they don't have the power. The dominant police culture or law enforcement culture is us versus them. We're the good guys, we should catch the bad guys. And if we cheat a little bit, bend the rules or, you know, impose our will, so be it, because, you know, the ends justifies the means. And same thing with prosecutors. I see so much pettiness and so much ego. Ego is more controlling of our court system than justice is, unfortunately. And you were bringing up that, you know, psychopaths, you know, they want to, they're attracted to positions of power, but who wants to climb to the top of an organization and have power over others, right? An average person really doesn't want to. It's more trouble than it's worth. And, you know, the people that rise to the top or that climb their way to the top are they're after power. And, you know, the police officers, prosecutors, and judges are no different They're all human beings and they fall under that rule.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. Really appreciate your perspective on all of this. Can you tell the people where to find more of your work if they'd like to follow it?
Sure. I'm on Twitter as Joseph Tully Law. I'm on Facebook as well. My book is California State of Collusion, and it is specific to California, but it really has a broad range and it could apply to any state and, you know, anywhere within our country. So I'm out there and I welcome any and all comments.
Thank you. This is so important. I really appreciate you talking about it.
I appreciate you talking about it. Thank you for bringing this to light.
Of course.